You're listening to Talk the Rock. I'm your host, Kayla Desroches, and I have some people from the Lüttich Museum with me today to speak to you about a new book that the Lüttich Museum just published. Could you go around and introduce yourselves?
Sure. I'm April Lactonen, counselor, and I'm the executive director at the Lüttich Museum.
I am Marnie Leist. I'm the curator of collections.
I'm Patrick Saltonstall, and I'm the curator of archaeology.
So this book is the culmination of a lot of hard work. Could you just first of all tell me about the site that this book focuses on?
I think Patrick would be best for that question.
Yeah, it's the site that brought me to Alaska, actually. I was a freshman in college, and I joined the dig in, like, I think 1985. Yep, 1985. And it was kind of a massive site with, like, all these beautiful wood artifacts, and we excavated there from first went there in 83, and they dug there. That first project went through 87, rather, and then we went back a couple times in the 90s, and it pretty much makes up the bulk of the Lüttich Museum. It's sort of the collection that kind of helped create the Lüttich Museum.
Mm-hmm. And could you tell me a little bit about how you felt first coming to Alaska and getting the opportunity to work on a site like this?
Yeah, it was very different than what I was used to. I was used to digging shell middens in Maine, and, you know, you'd find an occasional flake or occasional chip point. Then you come to Karlik and you're finding masks and carved spoons, and you're finding floors with green grass on them. I mean, it was very eye-opening for me. And it was also quite... You know, it was coming to Alaska. It was like all of a sudden the sun's up all the time. You know, it was, you're looking across the Shelikof and seeing smoking volcanoes. It was kind of amazing.
And so when did work begin on the book?
That might be more of a morning question.
2 years ago. So the site was excavated over numerous years. And actually it moved around the country. It went from Karlik to Bryn Mawr College to the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and then finally to the Lüttich Museum in 1995. Because it had been moved around so much, it was not organized. It was just in boxes. And over from 1995 to about 2010, the Lüttich Museum staff and volunteers had worked on it. We got a grant from the Institute of Museum and Library Services, where I and Carrie Barker, a collections assistant, went through it very systematically and identified pretty much every single piece out of the 26,000 pieces to make sure that we could assess condition, we could better store the collection, and that we had the comprehensive data. Once we completed that project, we then applied for another grant from IMLS to draft the manuscript.
Okay, and so when you were first excavating the site, did you ever think, well, one day this could make a gigantic novel of a book? This is just so much information.
No, I think at the time I was just sort of like, I'm in Alaska, and I'm finding cool stuff. And it is funny, when we started working on the collection, you know, doing the book, I actually went back and I found my notes from, like, the first day I was in Alaska. I was like, wow, you know, looked at my handwriting and everything, and it was all right there. But I wasn't thinking ahead. And in fact, the way we do archaeology now, where everybody who does the archaeology gets to do the lab work, at that time I never did lab work. I always just sort of went in the field, and I never really saw what came of what we were finding. Things have evolved a bit.
And what kind of things were you finding in the beginning and then as time moved on?
Oh, at Karlik?
Yes.
The way it worked... The top layer wasn't very good preservation. I remember we used to go through that very quickly, and there you'd find, like, old watches and, American period, cannery period, sort of historic stuff. And then you get down deeper, and you start to find, like, the wood floors. And the site is like a series of, like, 8 to 10 houses stacked up on top of each other. Basically... When people moved there, the whole site was just a gravel beach, but it's the prime spot to catch all the fish going up the Karlik River. But to build houses, they had to import dirt and sod and wood from the hillside and from the beach to the site. And then it sort of built up really rapidly, and the water was, there was a pond behind the site, so the site acted like a gigantic sponge. So it's like sort of trying to keep up above the water table. They had to build it up so quick, and that's why everything got preserved so well. So you, when we dig down, you'd start to find that you'd find wood posts for the corners of the houses. You'd find the wood floors. You'd find trenches where they tried to manage the water that was in the site all the time that were covered with boards. It was quite spectacular.
If you put a piece in the wood in the ground and come back 500 years later, you'll have
dirt.
Yeah, nothing. So it is spectacular to have this 500-year-old organic material, not just wood. There's baleen, little tiny baleen net, baleen lashing, woven spruce root baskets, grass baskets were preserved. So just an abundance of organic material. Much of it had never been seen before. You know, it used to be kind of the conjecture that Aleutic people were primarily stone workers, but clearly with the excavation of this site, that's just not true.
Yeah, I think from a cultural revitalization perspective, this site really changed our whole image of prehistoric Aleutic life, and it showed us that as community members, we have a lot to be proud of because the skill that it took to produce these amazing carvings and bentwood boxes and masks and dolls and the intricate baskets with the false embroidery designs, it's just amazing to see what was possible with just a lot of hard work. The technologies that we have in Western society weren't there, but they had different technologies that were designed specifically for the Kodiak environment. And that's why I think that this collection is of interest to not just the Aleutic community, but anyone that loves Kodiak Island, because this is a cultural heritage that was formed here, and it's very special.
Could you talk a little bit more about the technologies formed specifically for Kodiak?
Actually, probably one of the curators would be best to speak about it. I look at it more from a cultural revitalization and a personal perspective. So I look at things and I see the carved spoons and I think, wow, that's beautiful. Or I bet one of my grandparents used that. But, someone like Marnie or Patrick could probably speak to the actual tools used to produce those items or things like that.
And that's why the site is so amazing. Anyone interested in just traditional skills even, because we have an entire snapshot of what life was like 500 years ago. So we have household tools. We, of course, have masks and other things regarding spiritual life. But we have all the hunting tools, all the tools to make those hunting tools, and all the tools that to repair and transform those tools, because tools were constantly reused. I have had Patrick help me a lot figuring out the hunting tools could be really complex because one spear, it's not just one piece. It's like five or six different pieces, you know, put together, scarfed, tied together, meant to come apart. And you could put various pieces together to make different kinds of spears for different kinds of hunting or weather.
So they were like modular.
Well, it was also very difficult for us as archaeologists because we knew what the stone tools were, but there were so many wood tools that we had no idea what they were. What's the word, April?
Chanasuduk, which is thing for making something.
Yeah, we had that category, we called it dingthod, but we didn't know what it was, and there were so many of these things, and it's taken us years to figure out what many of them were. You sort of finally, like one time, we had the piece that joins the cockpit frame the cockpit to the frame. We had a bunch of those. We didn't know what they were. And one day we were looking at a kayak frame, and I was like, oh, there's the part. And so we took it out of that drawer and put it in with the kayak parts drawer. But that kind of thing happened a lot.
We should tell the story, or maybe you should, since you were there, the clam decoys.
Yeah, that was the other one. They were like little discs, and we called them clam decoys, the joke being that you'd throw them on the beach and the clams would crawl out. We really had no idea what they were, and we just found piles of them. And then we were talking to Aleutic elders, I think Larry Matfan in particular, and he was like, oh, those are Kaganic discs. It's a little game where you, like horseshoes, where you throw it at a target. And it is funny, a lot of the things that we didn't know what they were games, ended up being games. Oakshack darts, we thought they were knitting needles, I think.
The tally sticks.
The tally sticks we thought were nose pins.
Yeah, there's a lot of gambling going on back in the heyday.
Oh. Well, you know, you don't have your Xbox and your iPad, you know, to fill the time games.
Those dark winter nights were a good time to practice your dart skills or to, you know, win a few supplies to last you the rest of the winter. It was a big part of the culture at that time.
But another kind of cool thing is you'd find all the, we could learn about the process of how these things were made. Like I remember in a corner of a side room, I found a whole lot of wood chips, and then I found a pile of half-finished librettes and finished librettes. You know, the jewelry that you wear in your lips, and you could see how they've been carved with a beaver, you know, incised beaver tool, and it was kind of neat just to see the whole steps in how these things became tools as well.
These seem like really wonderful discoveries, and they tell you so much about how people lived during the time. So, just to return to how all these discoveries affected the view of Aleutic culture and Aleutic history. Can you talk a little bit about that, about how the more people uncovered stuff and interesting things and maybe artifacts they hadn't been aware of before, how that affected public perception?
Yeah, I think even though this dig happened in the 80s and 90s, a lot of the information hasn't really fully percolated our community, and people who have been involved with the museum or who have volunteered or been on the community archaeology digs, I think they're more aware of the richness of the history here on the island and the really amazing innovations, you know, the atlatls, the spear throwers, or the techniques used to weave a basket so that it would be almost watertight. Some of that information didn't get passed down generation to generation because of the acculturation and the colonization of the island. And so as Aleutic people and as other people interested in Aleutic culture, we can now reconnect with those parts of our past through these archaeological collections and through some of the ethnographic collections that we find around the world. And so the museum has worked to connect everyday people from today with this history. And so, you know, we do that by sending people to museums around the world so they can do research on stitching techniques or weaving or skin sewing or embroidery. And then we also have people that look in our collections for inspiration. We have a number of artists here in Kodiak that come to our collections room and work with us to take a look at the items that aren't on display, for example. And I think that is a way, without having the generation to generation pass down of information, that we are able to reclaim a little bit of what was lost during the historic period.
And the site is called Karlik One, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yes.
And one of the reasons that the publication is also so important along the same lines is that our director of research and publications scoured historic sources, so we put the entire site. So it's not just all about the artifacts. It tells the story of the dig, all the people that were affected, how the collection changed viewpoints and formed the museum, but also she placed the site and the history combining historic sources to put everything in context. So it tells a much broader story.
Yeah, Karlik was the largest settlement on Kodiak Island in its heyday, but this book is not just about Karlik. Kalunuk means from Karlik. The story comes from Karlik. But at the same time, this is sort of a similar story to life around the entire island at that time. And so, you know, I personally have family connections to Karlik, but at the same time, I think anyone that lives in Kodiak and that loves our history would find a lot about this story that's really universal, not just the cultural information, but how the dig was done and how community members were involved.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit more about the community members who helped on the site?
Well, and to go take it a step back, actually, it's sort of like I remember digging at the site and Gordon Puller showing up in a raft. He'd rafted down from Karlik Lake, and he was the president of CANA. And I just remember how everybody was excited by this stuff, you know, that was coming out, and they would have sort of show and tells. And I think it when you're talking about those collections around the world, no one even knew about those. No one knew about those collections. When they saw the stuff from Karlik, it kind of sparked sparked an interest in the old stuff. And I think it sparked, and then people went abroad and looked at the collections, I think. It was sort of the beginning of all that. And Gordon Puller and everybody, everybody decided they wanted a cultural center. They wanted a place to put the material from Karlik pretty much right away. That was the thinking, to keep the stuff in Kodiak. And we did have people from Canada digging. We had people from Karlik digging. There was people from town here coming down to visit and dig. It was a large undertaking.
And that actually is what makes the museum very important. One, you know, it used to be Canada, of course, now we also are doing research, but we can keep the collections here. We are one of the very few tribal museums in the state. And what the historic precedent is that, you know, collections were excavated and then went away, just like this one did. But because we have the museum, it's here, and we could do the research on it.
Right. And was that rare in archaeology? Where is it more common for people to come out from out of state and study?
Yeah, the historical pattern was that archaeologists from universities, and sometimes in the earlier days it wasn't even trained archaeologists, it was medical doctors, and anyone that had the power to do so could just go into a native community, dig up the whole graveyard or some other archaeological site, and then take everything away, and the people living there would really be confused about what had happened or very upset, and that did happen here on Kodiak Island. But this Karlik dig was very unique in that respect, that there was community support, community involvement, and although the collection did go away for a while for study, it was the intent all along, at least from the community's perspective, to bring it back. And so the building of the Aleutic Museum in 1995, that was the first collection, that and the Larsen Bay collections that came back to the museum to become the first collections.
And it is kind of a new, I like it better, you know, the working in a community museum and research that's community oriented, because it is true, the old sort of paradigm was university-based research, and the university asks the questions, whereas when we're a community-based museum, I think we try to answer community-based questions. It's sort of, we need to be relevant to the people who support us, and so I think it does better. It creates better research myself.
And that's why there's over 30 community contributors, everyone from people who were at the dig to scientists to fauna experts. We have a lot of different voices to tell the story.
Mm-hmm. And is there a section for these stories?
There are essays throughout the entire publication.
Oh, okay, great. So kind of like spotted here and there at the end of chapters, or where are they
mixed in?
Okay. And what are the other sections, or how is the book organized?
I would recommend reading the first little bit and then skipping to chapter 5. It's like, just get down to the meat of it and then to go back, because, you know, chapter 2, which discusses the entire Karlik River system, I mean, it's an extensive way. This is one site in the larger system, which Patrick explains very well in Chapter 2. And then by the time you get to Chapter 4, it tells the entire history of the excavation.
And how long is the book?
Over 400 pages, I think.
Yeah, it's a good 3 inches thick. It makes a good step stool.
Mm-hmm.
For when you're not reading it. It's, you know, I was even surprised. I worked on the some sections of the publication myself, and I knew all of the different contributors that were being asked to write sections for the book, but then when we actually opened those boxes and pulled them out, it really showed you how big this undertaking was, and it really impressed me, having, you know, just recently rejoined the museum as the director, to see all this, you know, work that had happened while I was working elsewhere. Even though I was involved, it was really impressive to see the results of all that labor.
Right. And besides spirituality, I know that that's one of the sections. What are some of the other themes that are covered in the book?
Economic life and household life.
And we sort of wrote that out. It was me to write economic life, and I read all the old accounts about Karlik. I looked in Russian everywhere. Because we sort of based the seasonal round what you would do if you lived in Karlik, you know, in a general way. You know, Karlik has really good fishing, but the sea mammal hunting isn't so great. You know, we sort of, birds, catching birds in the spring. We sort of did the whole season around for Karlik.
Okay. And you said you use Russian texts too?
Yep. A lot of it. Marnie was hinting at it earlier. I think that's one of the best aspects of this book is we really did comb all the ethnographic accounts and we tried to incorporate it all into the book. There's an appendix which sort of goes through all the sources. You get to read about who the different people we referenced are. Lisiansky, Holmberg. We talk about all the different what they contributed.
And when you say you read Russian texts, did you have a originally? Do you speak Russian?
No, all translations.
Okay.
Although we did have some pretty hard to find translations, like Lydia Black had done some that have never been published that we used.
All right. And what other kind of resources did you use besides Russian texts and the artifacts that you found?
We looked for historic photographs as well from collections. So we used one from the Anchorage Museum, I believe UAF. And Amy went to UAA, actually, to look at a collection from a school teacher who was there back in the 1950s, Charles Lussier. We utilized all the books that we had on site, and including oral histories as well, interviews from elders. But we also looked broader as well, what other institutions had about Karlik.
And there were some very weird, like, adventure novel type things that happened in Karlik that we read as well, like Monty Hawthorne or whatever, talking about the cannery days, so we could, like, sort of piece that together. We found some strange stuff to read there.
There's definitely information in the book that a lot of it no one has ever read or known before.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of new information.
And the group of elders that you're talking about that you used for as a resource, that's a group that was relatively recently kind of brought together, right, for this kind of a Lutic Renaissance that is going on right now in Kodiak.
Well, we've been working with elders and fluent speakers of the language since about 2002. So it's been 13 years that we've had a language program at the museum, and many of these elders had been involved previously with the museum's other programs. And before the official new language movement that kind of started in 2002, there were other precursors to that. The Aleutic Word of the Week has been around since 1997. It's one of our longest running programs, the same length of time that we've had the community archaeology dig, for example. But it was only in recent years, starting in 2007 or 2008, that we had elders begin work on creating new words for the language, and that's one of the things that we've incorporated into this book. There are existing words, for things like an ulu or a knife or a stone lamp, things that have remained sort of common in our community throughout the historic period. But other items like portions of a toggling harpoon or, little tiny pieces of a rig spreader to hunt or to fish for deep sea fish. These things, we don't know if there was even ever a word for it. And so what we wanted to do is give the elders a chance to connect with the archaeological collections and provide new names for the old items as a way of kind of putting our stamp on prehistory and say, this is our prehistory and we want to make it relevant to today and to today's learners of the language and people who are getting more connected with the Aleutic culture. And so the elders developed new terms that were based on the appearance or the function or the various other qualities of the item that they were looking at. And we had our two curators here come into the New Words Council meeting with some of those objects. Because in our initial work, just showing photos of the items or just describing them, the elders had a difficult time sometimes really picturing what we were talking about or figuring out the true function of a portion of a larger modular spear piece, for example. So we had them come in. They even brought strings and things like that to show how different tools functioned. And it really helped the elders create terms that were more accurate to the actual use of those items. A lot of times when we develop completely new words for the Aleutic language, the translation is quite literal. Our language is an agglutinative language, which means that you'll have a root word and then you can add additional suffixes to it or convert a verb into a noun or a noun into a verb just by putting the right ending on it. And so if you know that a tool is used for carving, for example, then you can turn it into a tool for carving as the literal translation, which would be klich sudak. I think that was one of the terms that was created. The elders also decided that they didn't want to create new words for every single thing. They do have limited time. We have only a handful of elders that are able to work with us these days. And so they also chose, in some instances, to apply existing words to old items to show that there was a cultural continuity there. So we have a word, for example, for a knife in modern day. Usually it's used for a steel knife. They also applied that word to the prehistoric knife. We have words in the modern day that, like for an axe. Well, we didn't have axes 500 years ago, but there were adzes in the collection, which have a similar use. So the elders applied the borrowed Russian word for axe and aluticized it and made it the word for adz as well. And so it was a really interesting process. We did little codes for each different term to show the creation method, whether it was an aluticized Russian word or a word that had been repurposed or a word that had been completely created from scratch in the language.
Can you pronounce the name of the book for me?
Kalunuk.
Okay,
The stress goes on the first syllable, which is contrary to how English-speaking people would normally say it. The word kalunuk is similar, but not exactly the same as the word for a honey bucket or a potty bucket. so that's why we've tried to be good with the pronunciation kalunuk instead of kalunuk. But even I have accidentally slipped a few times and called it kalunuk just because it's the way that it sort of comes out of your mouth as an English speaker.
Mm.
But if people just remember to put the stress on the first syllable, we should be good to go.
And who published the book?
The book was published by the University of Alaska Press.
Did they assign you an editor, or was it kind of always internal?
It was a very interesting process to work with the press. They were fabulous. They helped us with the design. Because a lot of the words were unknown and the topic is very, very Alaskan, there was some issues with editing that we basically had to go back and like undo edits. You know, like sea lion, not hyphenated. It's a sea lion.
And Don Clark also, he's an archaeologist who grew up in Kodiak. He helped a lot, but he did a lot of the editing and reading of it too.
Indeed, he did. And we had a couple of reviewers as well review the publication.
All right. And it's on sale right now. And where can people buy it?
If you go to the Aleutic Museum website, there should be a link there's like a special microsite just for the Kalunuk book because it's so special. And you can also just call the Aleutic Museum directly and order a copy or drop by the store.
Okay, and how much is it?
A discounted price of $50. We had actually many funders from individual donors to large corporate donors, which made actually that price possible.
All right. So thank you guys so much for stopping by and sharing all that you have gathered from this site and from this book. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, Koyana for the invite.